I mean,
some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Yes, yes.
But
I mean, tonight
we care, and it shows.
The law.
You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Another edition of Media Monarchy. My name's James. I'm your host. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority. It's the ninth episode of Media Monarchy. It's January 5th, 2007, New Year. Tons of news to go over. Of course, Democrats take over Congress. We got the McCain Doctrine. Bush is opening your mail. A little bit of George Carlin. Randy Rhoads and 9/11 collapses. A lot on Poppy Bush. Gloom and doom. Perhaps, and of course, Saddam's execution and all kinds of other stuff. MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com is the website. You got 2 hours of blacklisted news for you. We're going to get it started. It is the new year.
I'm Tim McGuire. A job shift for the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, President Bush nominating him to be Condoleezza Rice's top deputy. Bush then named retired Vice Admiral Mike McConnell to take Negroponte's place.
The vigilance of the DNI helps keep the American people safe from harm. Admiral Mike McConnell has the experience, the intellect, and the character to succeed in this position.
Matthew Aide, an expert on the NSA, says McConnell faces a daunting task when and if he takes over.
Admiral McConnell has a great big shoes to fill in that, you know, he's been out of the business for 10 years.
Negroponte, who began his career at the State Department, says he's thrilled to have the chance to be Deputy Secretary of State.
The position, Mr. President, to which you are now nominating me is an opportunity of a lifetime.
Both nominations will have to be confirmed by the Senate. And more is coming. AP National Security Correspondent Sagar Magani reports a defense official says there will soon be new brass running the Iraq war.
The official says the president is looking to replace Central Command Chief John Abizaid with Admiral William Fallon, who heads U.S. Pacific Command, and that Army Lieutenant General David Petraeus will replace George Casey as the top commander in Iraq. That would help the president show he's taking a fresh approach to Iraq ahead of putting out his new war plan.
Top British general in Iraq says every commander could use more troops. Major General Simon Mayo warns, however, that won't be enough to change the situation in Baghdad.
This is a complex issue, so I don't wish, when we talk surge, to simply think in bold terms of more American soldiers.
Mayo says the Iraqi government has to stabilize the country politically and economically. The Labor Department says 167,000 jobs were added to the nation's payrolls last month, more than expected. Diane Swank is the chief economist at Mesro Financial.
Hiring has picked up a little bit, especially not only in December, but with upward revisions to November.
Jobless rate, 4.5%. This is AP Radio News.
All right. This isn't really AP Radio News, but I thank them for the update. My name's James, and this is Media Monarchy. Every Friday, here on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, we give you the best uncovered news, uncovered for you, of the stuff in the news this morning. The FBI is reporting that late Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, was on drugs and was even hallucinating when he was trying to detox. Lots of other stuff going on and that we're going to get to today. Of course, Saddam's execution, death toll reaches over 3,000. If there's a theme for this episode, it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And our top story, coming from AP, of course, the Democrats take control of Congress with all the subtlety of a scenery-chewing B-movie actor. Coming from the AP, in a day of ceremony and historic change, Representative Nancy Pelosi became the nation's first female House Speaker on Thursday as Democrats eagerly took control of Congress for the final 2 years of President Bush's term. The Democrats are back, rejoiced Pelosi, and she immediately set the rank and file to work passing tougher ethics rules. Which is ironic, because if you dig a little bit, you'll see that she had some ethical difficulties herself. And of course, like you heard in the AP, Bush is shuffling the neocon deck. Kurt Nimmo has a great take on it. KurtNimmo.com, this story's posted. In an all-too-predictable game of musical chairs, the Bush neocons have decided to shuffle John Negroponte, the butcher of Honduras, and member in good standing at the Council on Foreign Relations, off to the State Department to work under Condi, and drop Khalilzad, the PNAC flunky, in to fill the space vacated by the unconfirmable John Bolton at the UN, and spend former Admiral Mike McConnell, a director at Booz Allen Hamilton, where the neocon World War IV James Woolsey runs shop, into the top spook position as National Intelligence Director. And also, W's pushing the envelope on U.S. spying, coming from the New York Daily News. President Bush has quietly claimed sweeping new powers to open Americans' mail without a judge's warrant, the Daily News has learned. The president asserted his new authority when he signed a postal reform bill into law on December 20th. Bush then issued a signing statement that declared his right to open people's mail under emergency conditions. That claim is contrary to existing law and contradicted the bill he had just signed, say experts who have reviewed it. Now, of course, again, as they were talking in the AP, Surge. That's the keyword. That's the other keyword for the show. Surge equals more dead people in Iraq. Jack Cafferty the other night on CNN blasted the McCain Doctrine, which equals surge. And he said, President Bush is expected to call for sending as many as 40,000 additional troops to Iraq, next week. Escalating the war is now being called a surge. Stay the course has been relabeled. It's the new way forward. We did this in Vietnam, remember? The U.S. kept sending troops over there, which only led to more people dying. And we got Jack Cafferty talking on CNN. Let's check it.
Well, President Bush is expected to call for sending as many as 40,000 additional troops to Iraq, next week. Escalating the war is now being called a surge. Stay the course has been relabeled. It's the new way forward. We did this in Vietnam, remember? The U.S. kept sending more troops over there, which only led to more people dying. Same thing will happen in Iraq. The United States is now an occupying army presiding over a civil war in Iraq. There is no way forward. Just more death, injury, and the squandering of our national treasury. This country has its belly full of this failed operation in Iraq. Read any public opinion poll. Is 3,006 deaths not enough? How many do you suppose it'll take before President Bush's conscience begins to bother him? 5,000? 10,000? More? How many? Meanwhile, the White House continues to try to get you to think that this is something it's not. The word surge is being used to camouflage the administration plans to escalate the war in Iraq. And it's not just about the troops. The White House says they're looking at a whole range of options, including on the economic front. Now, this little misadventure has already cost us $500 billion, and we're losing. But there's never been much of a market for reality in the Bush White House. It's all about the spin, you know. So next week, when the president talks about sending more of your sons and daughters to die in Iraq, don't think surge. Recognize it for what it is. Here's the question. Will you support President Bush if he calls for an escalation of the war in Iraq? Email us at CaffertyFile@CNN.com or go to CNN.com/CaffertyFile.
You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. One little quick bit of interesting news. Russian rocket comes down over Wyoming. Coming from, once again, AP, a spent Russian booster rocket re-entered the atmosphere Thursday over Colorado and Wyoming, NORAD said. Eyewitnesses reported seeing flaming objects in the sky at the time the rocket was re-entering. NORAD spokesman Lieutenant Commander Sean Kelly said, "It was pretty spectacular," said Riverton Police Captain Mark Stone, who said he saw the burning object while he was retrieving his newspaper. "My first concern is that we had some sort of aircraft that was coming down. It was definitely leaving a burning debris trail behind it." Stone said he could tell it was a fairly large object, but it was too high to make out exactly what it was. Kelly said the agency was unable to confirm a report that a piece of the rocket may have hit the ground near Riverton, Wyoming at about 6 a.m. yesterday. No damage was reported, and any debris that may have hit the ground was not believed to be hazardous, NORAD said. NORAD identified the rocket as an SL-4 that had been used to launch a French space telescope in December, and Kelly said U.S. space watchers knew the rocket was coming down. "Objects falling from space are almost an everyday occurrence," Kelly said. Donahue with Silver Rocket. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James, I'm your host. MediaMonarchy.com, that's MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com, rather, is the site. All the news that you hear on this show, it's all posted, it's all copiously linked. And speaking of links, been getting a lot more traffic to the site, and definitely over the holidays there was an upswing. And getting a lot more links to the site. But last week I got my first actual posting about Media Monarchy in general. A blog called ConcealedPosition.com posted a link about Media Monarchy. I printed it out. ConcealedPosition.com said, Media Monarchy is one of the better produced clearinghouses of conspiracy documentary that I've seen in a while. Most conspiracy sites suffer from an incoherent lack of organization that mirrors their owners' schizophrenic disordered personalities. That's one way I, and I suppose the FBI profilers, can distinguish between the wingnuts and the somewhat more dangerous fringe types. I found Media Monarchy while checking my own stats, but in the quest for placement, I often stumble upon something interesting. This was one of the better finds. I've added Media Monarchy to my pinned list, and I plan to revisit and repost when they come up with new and interesting things. So that was kind of cool, and it kind of struck me that I believe they called me a dangerous fringe type. So I posted a comment that said, thanks, I think, appreciate the compliments, but I can assure you I'm not a dangerous fringe type. Maybe it takes a little bit of bravery and stupidity to do this, but I think that the state of the world gives me little choice. So thanks for the link and welcome aboard. And they actually wrote back. Says, hey, thanks, and the dangerous fringe types was submitted rather tongue-in-cheek. My blog was called an example of a dangerous fringe type perspective by a law enforcement officer who has been investigating terrorist affiliations. I've since moderated my speech a little. Yes, I know. Please keep doing what you're doing. We need the perspective. But please remember, Dick Cheney is watching, and he's got friends who can and do unpleasant things. So that's kind of strange. And there's several other new links to Media Monarchy. Plato at WordPress, and the Man Common on MySpace, and the TalkingDog.com, all linking to MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. So that's cool. And there's probably been over 100 downloads of this very podcast. So if you downloaded this and you're checking it out at some other time, thank you very much. Tell somebody about it and pass it along and add a link to your page. But I digress. And we're going to keep moving with yet another story from the AP News. This is coming from, posted on My Way News, and it's the nuclear agency head dismissed for lapses. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman on Thursday dismissed the chief of the country's nuclear weapons program because of security breakdowns at the Los Alamos, New Mexico laboratory and other facilities, and that was reported on in the second episode, Media Monarchy. The fired man is named Linton Brooks, and he said he'd leave in 2 weeks to 3 weeks as head of the National Nuclear Security Administration, a post he has held since May 2003. Bodman said the nuclear agency under Brooks, a former ambassador and arms-controlled negotiator, had not adequately fixed security problems and said, quote, I've decided it's time for new leadership at the NNSA. Brooks told agency workers in a statement, this is not a decision that I would prefer, but I accept the decision and you need to do likewise. He characterized the demand for his resignation as, quote, based on the principle of accountability that should govern all public service. When it was learned that Brooks did not inform his superiors for 8 months about the computer theft of data on 1,500 employees, Representative Joe Barton last year sought Brooks' immediate dismissal. His departure is long overdue, Barton, a representative Republican from Texas, said Thursday, and I've got the other link to the previous story on Media Monarchy. Coming up next, and I mentioned him before, and I'll be mentioning him again, Kurt Nimmo has one of the best insightful, well-written blogs out there, KurtNimmo.com, KurtNimmo.com. Next story coming from him is Sacrifice Translates into More Dead People. Is John Keating 5 McCain sincerely clueless? And there's a link there, and you should remember Keating 5 back in the 80s savings and loan scandal. John McCain is a criminal. Or is he simply a politician playing a cynical numbers game with Iraq and thus eventually condemning to certain death more troops that should be here at home protecting our borders? McCain told General John Abizaid he didn't understand why the United States cannot control Al-Anbar province, and was flummoxed the general would suggest the mission is to train Iraqis to fight the insurgency, actually a popular resistance against both occupation by foreign troops and their hand-picked Iraqi proxy. McCain expressed frustration that said insurgents have taken back Al-Anbar, thus demonstrating you can't teach an old dog new tricks, or at least teach him a bit of history, and the inevitability of defeat for those who invade and attempt to occupy, as the French lost Vietnam at Dien Bien Phu, and the British lost Afghanistan at the Gandamak Pass. In Iraq, the Brits were unable to control continual uprisings against occupation, even though they used mustard gas, a weapon favored by Winston Churchill for the likes of uncivilized tribes. And there's links there for all those failed occupations. That was the British couldn't control Iraq back in the 1920s, so Churchill used mustard gas. John McCain, the Manchurian candidate for president in 2008, does not even seem vaguely aware of such historical realities.
Anbar province under control before we have another battle of Fallujah and lose many more lives because the insurgents have taken control of a good part of Al-Anbar province?
Senator McCain, I believe that the Marines have done an excellent job in securing the key areas of Al-Anbar province, Ramadi and Fallujah. They are the two most decisive areas. I believe that you can't have a main effort everywhere, and that the preponderance of military activity needs to go into the Baghdad area.
I don't understand that tactic, General. You just told Senator Graham that General Shinseki was right, that we did not have enough troops there after the initial military operations. Is that correct?
I believe that more Iraqi security forces that were available would have made a big difference. I believe more international forces would have made a big difference.
Would more American troops have made a difference?
I think you can look back and say that more American troops would have been advisable in the early stages of June, July.
Did you note that General Zinni, who opposed the invasion, now thinks that we should have more troops? Did you notice that General Batiste, who was opposed to the conduct of this conflict, says that maybe tens of thousands of additional troops? I don't understand, General. When you have a part of Iraq that's not under our control, and that and yet we still, as Al-Anbar province is, which has been, well, I don't know how many American lives have been sacrificed in Al-Anbar province, but we still have enough, and we will rely on the ability to train the Iraqi military when the Iraqi army hasn't sent the requested number of battalions into Baghdad.
Senator McCain, I met with every divisional commander, General Casey, the Corps commander, General Dempsey. We all talked together, and I said, in your professional opinion, if we were to bring in more American troops now, does it add considerably to our ability to achieve success in Iraq? And they all said no. And the reason is because we want the Iraqis to do more. It's easy for the Iraqis to rely upon us to do this work. I believe that more American forces prevent the Iraqis from doing more, from taking more responsibility for their own future. They will win the insurgency, they will solve the sectarian violence problem, and they'll do it with our help. If more troops need to come in, they need to come in to make the Iraqi army stronger. That's my professional opinion.
General Batiste also says that if there was congressional approvals for troop proposals for troop withdrawals is, quote, terribly naive, unquote. Do you agree with that comment?
Under the current circumstances, I would not recommend troop withdrawals.
So we have sufficient number of forces to clear insurgent sanctuaries, hold the territory with a combination of coalition and Iraqi forces, provide sufficient security in Iraq so that economic reconstruction and political activity can take place, to arrest the momentum of sectarian death squads, disarm militias, to train the Iraqi army and keep an American presence in Iraqi units and place U.S. personnel in Iraqi police units. We have sufficient troops to carry out all those tasks.
We have sufficient troop strength, Iraqi and American, to make those tasks become effective.
Was it encouraging when in broad daylight that yesterday or the day before that people dressed in police uniforms are able to come in and kidnap 150 people and leave with them and go through checkpoints? General, it's not encouraging to us. It's not encouraging to those of us who heard time after time that things are, quote, progressing well, that we're making progress, etc., because we're hearing from many other sources that that's not the case. And I'm, of course, disappointed that basically you're advocating the status quo here today, which I think the American people in the last election said that is not an acceptable condition for the American people. So I regret your position that apparently against the recommendation of most military experts that we do not have sufficient. Al-Anbar province is a classic example of that, that you still are continuing to hold this position when numerically most of the attacks, most of the kidnappings, most of the others continue to be on a rise in Baghdad itself, where, as you say, the majority of our effort takes place. And so I respect you enormously. I appreciate your service. I regret deeply that you seem to think that the status quo and the rate of progress we're making is acceptable. I think most Americans do not.
Well, Senator, I agree with you. The status quo is not acceptable. And I don't believe what I'm saying here today is the status quo. I am saying we must significantly increase our ability to help the Iraqi army by putting more American troops with Iraqi units in military transition teams, to speed the amount of training that is done, to speed the amount of heavy weapons that gets there, and to speed the ability of Iraqi troops to deploy. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. Senator, I believe in my heart of hearts that the Iraqis must win this battle with our help. We can put in 20,000 more Americans tomorrow and achieve a temporary effect. But when you look at the overall American force pool that's available out there, the ability to sustain that commitment is simply not something that we have right now with the size of the Army and the Marine Corps. We can win with the Iraqis if we put our effort into the Iraqis as our first priority, and that's what I think we should do. I don't think that's status quo. I think that's a major change.
Thank you very much, General.
Could I just say in response, Mr. Chairman, you say we need to do all these things, train the Iraqi. I don't know where those troops come from, number one, and many of us believe that this may not be a long-term commitment, but at least a commitment to bring Baghdad under control. And that is not happening today. And that is, in my view, where you and I have significant disagreement. I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Significant disagreements. Basically, two killers arguing whether they want to murder people fast or slow. But getting back to our story, written by Kurt Nimmo. Forget Al-Anbar. The Pentagon can't even secure Baghdad, and will be unlikely to do so even if they send another 20,000, 30,000, or even 100,000 troops into the neocon-constructed meat grinder. Next, we are told, Bush will announce a smaller number than McCain has in mind, 15,000 troops, not 20,000. Instead of a surge, it's a bump, an anonymous person in Condi's State Department told McClatchy newspapers, thus reducing to a niggling degree the severity of sacrifice. When neocons and one-world types start talking about sacrifices, it's time to head for the hills. Admittedly, Bush may not know what he's doing from one moment to the next, as he is a former drunk and drug abuser and thus a mental graveyard. But his coterie of neocons most certainly know what they're doing, coming up with excuses to send more troops into Iraq, not to win that which cannot be won, as another basket case McCain would have us believe, but rather to see through mission accomplished, which is the destruction and balkanization of Iraq. It's a work in progress with horrifying results. For instance, last weekend, a series of car bombings killed more than 70 people in Shia neighborhoods in the hours after Saddam was lynched by a gaggle of puppets installed by the neocons. Americans are a patient lot and will likely give Bush the time and backing he needs to take another shot at getting U.S. policy in Iraq that works, a scribbler over at AP says. And the new democratically-led Congress, which convened yesterday, probably won't block the commander-in-chief if he decides to briefly increase troop levels. In other words, the American people can be expected to do nothing, or nothing effective, to put an end to the carnage, never mind the increasing flights of flag-draped coffins offloaded at Dover Air Force Base. Of course, most Americans, many unable to find Iraq on a map, don't know a thing about the 650,000-plus Iraqis slaughtered, and even if they did, a whole lot of them wouldn't care. Of course, we can't expect Democrats, now taking up their places in the great corporate and special interest whorehouse on the Potomac, to consider such nuances, as some of them, for instance, Silvestri Reyes, the incoming chairman of the House of Representatives Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, can't be bothered to tell the crucial differences between Sunni and Shia. Naturally, neocons know the difference, and that's why they do the things they do. Get ready to sacrifice indeed. Next up, Iran. And so, once again, that's coming from Kurt Nimmo at KurtNimmo.com. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com, and MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. We're going to slightly change it up right now and listen to one of my favorites, George Carlin, with a bit called The Owners of This Country that was featured in the ABC special Life is Worth Losing. ABC? No, HBO. What difference does it make? However, this bit was actually cut out from the album they released, but if you go to the video, Life is Worth Losing by George Carlin, you can listen to him talk about the owners of this country.
Life is filled with interesting things. That's why I could never commit suicide. I'm having too much fun keeping an eye on you folks, watching what you do. Human behavior. That's what I like. Humans do some really interesting things. Like, besides killing ourselves, we also kill each other. Murder. And we're the only ones who do that, by the way. Humans are the only species on Earth that deliberately kills members of another species for personal gain. Or pleasure. Sometimes it's just fun. We're also the only species that deliberately kills members of another species for personal gain. Or pleasure. That's what hunters do. They kill for pleasure. That's us. Human beings. Interesting folks. Murderers. Here's an interesting form of murder we come up with. Assassination. You know what's interesting about assassination? Well, not only does it change those popularity polls in a big fucking hurry, but it's also interesting to notice who it is we assassinate. Do you ever notice who it is? Stop to think of who it is we kill. It's always people who've told us to live together in harmony and try to love one another. Jesus, Gandhi, Lincoln, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, John Lennon. They all said, try to live together peacefully. Bam! Right in the fucking head. Apparently, we're not ready for that. Yeah, that's difficult behavior for us. Not too bright, folks. Not too fucking bright. But if you talk to one of them about this, if you isolate one of them, you sit them down rationally, and you talk to them about the low IQs and the dumb behavior and the bad decisions, right away they start talking about education. That's the big answer to everything. Education. They said, we need more money for education. We need more books, more teachers, more classrooms, more schools. We need more testing for the kids. You say to them, well, you know, we've tried all of that, and the kids still can't pass the test. They say, oh, don't you worry about that. We're going to lower the passing grades. And that's what they do in a lot of these schools now. They lower the passing grades so more kids can pass. More kids pass, the school looks good, everybody's happy, the IQ of the country slips another 2 or 3 points, and pretty soon all you'll need to get into college is a fucking pencil. Got a pencil? Get the fuck in there. It's physics. Then everyone wonders why 17 other countries graduate more scientists than we do. Education! Politicians know that word. They use it on you. Politicians have traditionally hidden behind three things. The flag, the Bible, and children. No child left behind. No child left behind. Oh, really? Well, it wasn't long ago you were talking about giving kids a head start. Head start? Left behind? Someone's losing fucking ground here. But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The big, the wealthy, the real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media news, all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting fucked by a system that threw them overboard 30 fucking years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your fucking retirement money. They want it back. So they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this fucking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. And by the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hard-working people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hard-working people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich cocksuckers who don't give a fuck about them. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't give a fuck about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Yeah. You know? And nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue dick that's being jammed up their assholes every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it. You have to be asleep to believe it. You have to be asleep to believe it. You have to be asleep.
Our next story on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. Randy Rhodes, 9/11 collapses and Bush administration lies. This is coming from 9/11 blogger. In the third hour of her January 2nd radio show, Randy Rhodes discussed Bush Sr.'s recent odd behavior, which we're going to get to in just a little bit. Randy Rhodes discussed Bush Sr.'s recent odd behavior, referencing the Warren Commission report and JFK conspiracy theories during a speech at Ford's Memorial. Randy drew comparisons to his recent breakdown while giving a speech regarding his son Jeb. She questions whether this recent strange behavior is due to a forthcoming wave of questions by the incoming Democratic majority. Don't hold your breath. Amongst this segment, Randy quite bluntly questions the collapses of the Twin Towers as well as World Trade Center 7. Let's hope that Randy will continue to voice her concerns over what really happened on 9/11 and that her voice won't fall on deaf ears with the incoming Democratic majority.
George Sr. gets up at Gerald Ford's funeral today and eulogizes him by saying, you know, the conspiracy theorists can go to hell because the Warren Commission found that JFK was murdered by a lone assassin in the book depository in Dallas with Mrs. White and Colonel Mustard at noon on November 22nd, 1963. And Gerald Ford signed off on it. And he wouldn't have done it if it wasn't true. So, screw the conspiracy. And why would he pick that to say at Gerald Ford's funeral? Why would he pick that? Why? Because we're about to have investigations about everything from war profiteering to what happened to us on 9/11 to whether or not the intelligence was cooked for this war to what happened at the Battle of Tora Bora to you name it. To whether or not Halliburton was advocated for by Dick Cheney, and why are they the big winners in this war besides for Iran? You know, it's all. And so his father gets up there, and he's almost choking up when he talks about it too. Like, conspiracy theorists can all go to hell. They're going to do it to my son too. I just know it. And we need a presidential commission that's going to undo the congressional commissions that are going to listen and have hearings about all these issues. Because America can't handle the truth. And so they need to be lied to. You know, this has always been the arrogance of the Bush family and their power. That we couldn't handle the truth about JFK's death. That we couldn't handle the truth about RFK's death. That we couldn't handle the truth about Martin Luther King's death or Malcolm X's death. Or any, that we can't handle the truth about September 11th. And the truth is, we can't handle the lies. America stopped trusting its government after the Warren Commission report came out. For 1 year, when JFK was assassinated, America held its breath, hoping that the government would answer the questions. Why were people pointing to the grassy knoll and not the book depository? Just like Martin Luther King's photograph at the hotel, the Lorraine Hotel, Lorraine Motel. Jesse Jackson and others are standing on the balcony. Everybody's pointing in one direction. They tell us that Martin Luther King was shot from the other direction. That's the official report. Meanwhile, everybody's pointing in one direction. The official report says, oh, no, it came from this direction. Because the American people can't handle the truth. This country can't handle any more lies. And Bush 41 standing guard. I'm a government guy. Believe your government. When your government tells you those buildings fell in that orderly fashion, including Building 7, which was never hit, because that's the way buildings fall. When no building has ever fallen from fire, ever, here we have three. You better believe the government. I'm telling you. You know what's good for you. So we're about to get a lot of questions at least asked. Whether or not the people who answer them choose to lie, that's up to them. But America has had it with lies. And it's been 40 years of lies. 40 years of big, huge government deception. Everybody goes, what happened to the greatest generation? What happened to this country? Everybody got lied to. And quite frankly, this democracy can't handle it anymore. The truth will set us free.
And so that's Randy Rhodes talking about old Poppy Bush. And that brings us to our next story on Media Monarchy. Coming from Paul Joseph Watson at PrisonPlanet.com, Poppy Bush attacks JFK conspiracy theorists. During his speech at Gerald Ford's funeral service, former President George H.W. Bush bashed JFK conspiracy theorists and defended the Warren Commission report, another odd public outburst indicative of a crime family whose decades of misdeeds may finally be catching up with them. Bush said, quote, after a deluded gunman assassinated President Kennedy, our nation turned to Gerald Ford and a select handful of others to make sense of that madness. And the conspiracy theorists can say what they will, but the Warren Commission report will always have the final definitive say on this tragic matter. Why? Because Jerry Ford put his name on it, and Jerry Ford's word was always good. The only thing Ford was good for was running defense for criminals when he pardoned the remorseless Richard Nixon and others after Watergate, allowing larcenous felons to walk free and leaving the legacy in place that it's okay to break the law if you're a president, a form of absolutism that has been keenly inherited by the current crop of crooks, including Dick Cheney, who praised Ford for allowing the nation to heal by protecting a cadre of organized crime gangsters. Of course, all this had nothing to do with liberals or conservatives, bricklayers or office clerks, writes Kurt Nemo. It had to do with breaking the law, with dirty tricks, snooping on political opponents, sabotaging Democratic presidential candidates, going after Daniel Ellsberg for the public service he provided by bringing the Pentagon Papers to light, ordering the FBI to investigate CBS News reporter Daniel Schorr, discussing the possibility of having newspaper columnist Jack Anderson assassinated, and other crimes, evading taxes, accepting illicit campaign contributions, ordering secret bombings, and harassing opponents with executive agencies' wiretaps and break-ins, all of it culminating in Watergate. There's no doubt that Ford, not unlike Saddam Hussein, who died days after, knew where the bodies were buried, and Bush was simply eulogizing his noble service in sweeping the JFK assassination under the rug, shielding Poppy himself from serious questions about his own involvement in the events at Dealey Plaza. As Wayne Mattson comments, quote, "The elder Bush cannot really remember where he was on November 22, 1963. He later claimed he was in Tyler, Texas, although there is evidence that he was checked into the Dallas Sheraton Hotel that day. Mr. Bush, the conspiracy theorists will continue to say what they will until you start telling the truth about Zapata Oil, George de Morenschild, Operation Mongoose, New Orleans, and J.M. Wave." Bush Sr.'s outburst marked the second time in the same amount of months that he has felt the need to publicly attack those who would normally be relegated to the fringes of political discourse by big media consensus. During an appearance with his wife Barbara on Fox News in November, George Bush Sr. slammed internet bloggers for creating an adversarial and ugly climate, echoing the rhetoric of fellow neocons in the White House itself and trashing the reputation of the World Wide Web and the political blogosphere. The fact that Bush is being pressured into bad-mouthing so-called conspiracy theories and bloggers proves that the chorus of dissent is beginning to make these cretins lose some sleep at night. The Bush family as a whole is starting to exhibit some seriously offbeat behavior that suggests their decades of underhanded chicanery, murders, cover-ups, and scams are finally beginning to catch up with them.
But a former president has now broken down in tears in public. It's George H.W. Bush, father of the current president, whom he defended against hostile questions in the Middle East 2 weeks ago. But also, of course, father of the departing governor of Florida. And it was at the latter's final leadership forum that the waterworks were turned on as the father recalled son Jeb's loss in the governor's race in 1994.
They came down the home stretch. He saw some unpleasant things happen, unfair stuff, but he didn't whine about it, and he didn't complain. Barbara will blow me out for breaking up, but I... Anyway, it went on. The true measure of a man is how you handle victory and also defeat. So in 94, Floridians chose to rehire the governor. But they took note of his defeated opponent, who showed not merely with words, but by his actions, what decency and
I can do it.
That level of emotion seemed to be at some variance from the former president's relationship with his other son, you know, the current president. And that's especially notable in light of the perception that the Bush 41 team is now providing something of a crutch for Bush 43, which does not really come across when you hear Bush 43 talk about Bush 41 as he did in an interview on Fox News Channel's special report with Britt Hume.
He understands what I know, that the level of information I have relative to the level of information most other people have, including himself, is significant, and that he trusts me to make decisions. I love to talk to my dad about, you know, things between a father and a son, not policy. My attitude is I ought to absorb and listen to everything that's being said. And so I'm listening to the Iraqis. I want to listen to members of Congress. I want to listen to, obviously, Baker Hamilton.
Listening, it seems, to everybody but the only man who has been both an ex-president and the father of a current president since John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, left office early in 1829. Something does not seem to be adding up here. To try to figure out exactly what that is, let's turn to James Moore, who has covered the Bush family for 30 years. He's author of both Bush's Brain and Bush's War for Re-election. Cover of Newsweek, Father Knows Best, Current President, My Father and I Don't Talk Policy. Somebody seems to have gotten something wrong here. Do you know what it is?
Well, I don't think they do talk policy, Keith. I think it's interesting that the former president is reduced to tears talking about Jeb, and much of the rest of the country is reduced to tears thinking and talking about the current Bush in the White House. But what they talk about, I mean, I remember years ago here in Texas when they were first considering running for the presidency, and the president was trying to be jocular with a bunch of us who are reporters, trying to be hail fellow, well met, and he's bringing us into this big event kind of thing. And we ask him, what do you talk to your father about? And he, in that guy kind of way, said, well, we talk about baseball and girls. And of course, he used a less than appreciative term to describe women. So I think their relationship is about something other than that. But the truth is, at the moment, the president is having to return to his father and the people that the father used as resources in his administration, because he has nowhere else to turn. Even James Baker, who this president has never had any kind of fondness for, he called on him in Florida, and he's calling on him now, kind of outsourcing the whole mess in Iraq, to say, please, daddy's best friend, come help me out.
All right, explain what we saw from Mr. Baker's best friend. When his son, the president, was criticized in the United Arab Emirates, Bush 41 defended him. He said, my son is an honest man. He got angry at the questioner when he reflected on his son, the governor, losing an election for an office he later attained anyway. He started weeping. Do we infer anything out of those different reactions, or is that just none of our business?
Well, I certainly do, because I think that for years, the current president, his relationship with his father has been informed by a certain amount of petulance and jealousy. I mean, he's always been living up to this standard, or trying to. Dad had an oil company. W went out and drilled oil wells. Dad ran for Congress. W ran for governor. Dad got elected to the White House. W got reelected to the White House. Dad played first base for Yale. W managed a baseball team. It's always been that kind of relationship, except the problem is that back in Texas in those days, in the early 90s, the belief among everybody here and in Florida was that Jeb was going to win that race in the 90s, and he was going to be the one best positioned to run for the White House, because frankly, through the years, he's been acknowledged within and without of the family as the best and the brightest. And I think what's happened now, a part of what caused those tears for the former president, is that he realizes that Jeb's run in public life is pretty much done because of the Bush fatigue that this country faces. There is not going to be a Bush running for public office. It would be political suicide for anyone associated with him. I'm inclined to believe that not even young George P. will be able to run for school board eventually.
To say nothing of the twins. And I've got to interject this. Some of those Yale baseball teams from the 40s could have beaten some of W's Texas Rangers baseball teams. We don't have to get into that.
Yeah, but let's remember, W was the guy who traded Sammy Sosa, so we should have known by his decisions then.
Well, maybe he knew something. I mean, I actually give him credit for that, but that's another, again, okay. That's another interview for another kind of program. All right, so you and I have said this. Me as a layman, certainly looking from a considerable distance, saying, I wonder if Bush 41 is standing there saying, the wrong son became president. It's one thing for you to say it or for me to say it. Is it really possible that he could have been wondering that at that moment?
Oh, I think everybody in the family is, and I think that the president, the former president, is certainly thinking that and wondering about it. He has to be looking back and seeing what has happened over the course of the past 6 years and being terribly disappointed. He was an internationalist when he was president, and his son has gone on the international scene and screwed everything up royally and harmed the United States' reputation. Jeb was the intellect in the family. W was the guy who never wanted to do anything except for hang out, play baseball, watch baseball, have a beer with his buddies, and party. And he once told me on the plane, back when he was talking to us lowly Texas reporters during the campaign, he once told me, when I asked him in a private moment, I said, what do you do if you lose this? And he says, it's not such a big deal. I'll go back to Dallas. I'll sit on some boards. I'll work work for some oil companies. I'll watch a lot of baseball games, and Laura and the girls and I will have a great life. I don't think he really wanted this, and I think by the way he has run the White House, it's pretty clear that he is in many ways almost contemptful of the responsibility, that he was pressured to it.
Well, if he didn't want it, that makes it almost unanimous. Jim Moore, who has covered the Bush family for 30 years, co-author of Bush's Brain, great thanks for joining us again, sir.
Thanks for having me.
So, Poppy Bush attacks JFK conspiracy theorists at Gerald Ford's funeral. He burst into tears last month during a speech at Jeb's leadership forum. And Jeb Bush recently declared that he had no future. So, George W. Bush's obvious deteriorating mental acumen, characterized by a constant supply of Bushisms, has led several commentators to conclude that the current president is in the early stages of presenile dementia. The Bush daughter's behavior doesn't seem to be maturing with age either, after U.S. embassy officials strongly urged them to cut short last month's escapade in Argentina. Are the Bushes breaking down? Is the fact that the president is less popular than Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and Satan combined starting to finally provoke pangs of conscience among the notorious crime family? Do any of the Bushes even have a conscience? And that's coming from Paul Joseph Watson at PrisonPlanet.com. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. Our next story, oh, it's a fun one. Pat Robertson predicts mass killing. Coming from, once again, the Associated Press and what has become an annual tradition of prognostications, religious broadcaster Pat Robertson predicted Tuesday that a terrorist attack on the U.S. would result in mass killing late in 2007. I'm not necessarily saying it's going to be nuclear, he said during his news and talk television show, The 700 Club, on the Christian Broadcasting Network. The Lord didn't say nuclear, but I do believe it will be something like that. Robertson said God told him during a recent prayer retreat that major cities and possibly millions of people will be affected by the attack, which should take place sometime after September. Robertson said God also told him that the U.S. only feigns friendship with Israel and that U.S. policies are pushing Israel toward national suicide. Robertson suggested in January 2006 that God punished then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon with a stroke for ceding Israeli-controlled land to the Palestinians. The broadcaster predicted in January 2004 that President Bush would easily win re-election. Bush won 51% of the vote that fall, beating Democratic Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts. He also predicted Bush's victory for a second term. I have a relatively good track record, he says. Sometimes I miss. In May, Robertson said God told him that storms and possibly a tsunami were to crash into America's coastline in 2006. That's the Pacific Northwest coastline. Even though the U.S. was not hit with a tsunami, Robertson said on Tuesday, cited last spring's heavy rains and flooding in New England as partly fulfilling the prediction.
And I think people, Terry, are interested in finding out, since we were talking about 2007, I've been away for a prayer retreat, and I've put these things out with humility, but nevertheless, I have a relatively good track record. Sometimes I've missed. But.
And without doubt, every year as you seek God, I guess this is his promise to all of us, but as you go away and seek him for the coming year, God shows you some amazing things.
The first thing, Terry, that I think is God's word to his people, to the believers worldwide, not just here in America. And the promise is that this year is going to be a year of extraordinary miracles. And if I'm hearing the Lord right, there's such extraordinary things going to take place. Victory over demonic powers, victory of healing, some dramatic miracles taking place in people's lives. And the Lord said it's going to seem to the people like heaven has come down to earth. It's going to be that good. It's going to be really an extraordinary demonstration of God's power. The other thing he said was that this is the final year of the great demonstration of his grace to the world. For the last 12 years, we have seen evangelism unprecedented in countries like India and Indonesia and Nigeria and so forth. And CBN right now has, we have recorded somewhere in the neighborhood of 461 million decisions since the fall of communism. Well, that is going to come, I think, to an end, at least that great anointing. Well, the other thing I felt was that evil men, evil people, are going to try to do evil things to us and to others during the last part of this year. I don't know whether it'll be in the fall or September or later on, but it'll be the second half somehow of 2007. There will be some very serious terrorist attacks. The evil people will come after this country, and there's a possibility that chaos is going to rule. And the Lord says the politicians will not have any solutions for it. There's just going to be chaos. Now, of course, we saw chaos in the Gulf after Katrina. Mm-hmm. The politicians had no answers.
I think that rang in every resonant in everyone's heart as they looked at it and realized that when something big happens,
we're not ready. It's going to happen. And I'm not saying necessarily nuclear. The Lord didn't say nuclear, but I do believe it'll be something like that. That'll be a mass killing. Possibly millions of people, major cities injured. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope people will pray and that won't happen. But nevertheless, that seems to be what's coming up. And then the Lord said he will restrain the evil people, but he will not restrain them necessarily initially. And, you know, he doesn't have to restrain people. You know, they're evil people, and they do evil things, and they desire evil. The other thing on my heart and on his heart is the nation of Israel. And what he says was the United States pretends to be the supporter of Israel, but that we are pushing Israel toward a national suicide. Our policies are pushing Israel toward national suicide. And he also said that the policies of the current Israeli administration are, quote, toxic for the nation of Israel. So the last couple of years, he has said that we're entering into the most dangerous time in the history of Israel. That has been borne out by this last war they had. It's clear that another war sooner or later is coming, but the word was that the Olmert policies were toxic for the nation of Israel, and that the United States was feigning friendship but pushing them toward national suicide. So these are some of the things. The other thing is that there's going to be a great anointing of his spirit upon his people. The believers are going to have just an extraordinary time. And the last word that I got was on New Year's Day, and that took from the 10th chapter of Ezra, where you remember when the Jewish people had come back from captivity, the Lord had given them a little respite, and lo and behold, they immediately began to break his word and to intermarry with the heathen people. And Ezra was overwhelmed, the scribe, and he called for a national repentance, and he said, "You've got to put away from you this evil." Well, I thought, how does this apply to us? And the truth is that the Christians particularly have intermarried with the evil. We have television that is just full of evil. We have motion pictures full of evil, not only violence, but sexuality and permissiveness. And then on the Internet, we have all kinds of evil that people are allowing themselves to get into. And then more than that, there's this era of materialism where we're caught up in it. And it was as if God is saying, you've got to put away from yourself those heathen influences that are taking over, because I'm going to do something wonderful for you, but it's not going to happen unless you put away the heathen influences. So I believe that it's going to be, these first few months I'm looking forward to, it is going to be an extraordinary time, and we should expect miracles beyond our wildest fantasies in the first 6 months. And after then, chaotic.
Take
Black Rebel Motorcycle Club here on Media Monarchy. Into the second hour, you're listening to Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and the website is mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. This is where you can find all the news and links and videos and sounds that you hear on this show every Friday on the Portland Radio Authority. Our next story, coming once again from Paul Joseph Watson, is definitely something to keep in mind as the Democrats take the Congress with much pomp and hubris. Democrats set to renew attack on free speech. A new piece of legislation set to be reintroduced in Congress by the Democrats under the guise of anti-bullying would reprimand school children for verbal criticism of their peers in any context, including sexual orientation, religion, or simply expression of an opposing idea. The bill echoes federal hate crime legislation about to be debated as Congress enters its first session. The Anti-Bullying Campaign Act of 2005 was rendered obsolete after the recent expiration of Congress, but Fox News Radio reports that its most ardent champion, Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, is set to initiate its reintroduction. The bill outlines a $300 million federal program to target bullies who harass other kids about their sexual orientation, gender identity, or religion. However, the language of the legislation is so loosely defined that it could punish kids for simply verbally disagreeing with another student about so-called alternative lifestyles. The bill defines harassment as, quote, conduct including verbal conduct that creates or would create a hostile environment by substantially interfering with a student's educational benefits, opportunities, or performance, or with a student's physical or psychological well-being. Harassment would be taken to include any distinguishing characteristics of an individual, including actual or perceived race, color, national origin, ethnicity, religion, disability, sexual orientation, sex, gender identity or expression, family composition or circumstance, or economic circumstance. Targeting young children for the words they say and the behavior they exhibit is a reflection of a control freak society gone overboard. In a recent article, Paul Joseph Watson highlighted several cases where kindergarten kids as young as 5 were having sexual harassment offenses placed on file for pinching another child's bottom. How toddlers and extremely young children can engage in sexual harassment when they don't even know what sex is nor have any sexual feelings matters not to county officials across the country who are following these nightmare socialist-style policies by the book. All of these measures are aimed at getting kids in the system from a very early age and training them that obedient docility is the only conduct that will be tolerated. Perfect automatons for the state who will grow up to accept the mandate that all free speech is offensive to somebody and should therefore be highly regulated. The anti-bullying legislation dovetails a similarly reinvigorated federal hate crimes law that, according to commentators, could lead, quote, directly to an end of free speech. The law, or rather the Local Law Enforcement Enhancement Act, criminalizes any public criticism of homosexuality, transvestites, witches, pedophiles, Satanists, and others who lead self-professed alternative lifestyles, defining any disagreement and debate with these groups as hate crime. The bill also classifies sexist words used by men during intercourse as rape and greases the skids for the criminalizing criticism of the Jewish political lobby in Washington, along with a whole raft of other Twilight Zone regulations. Decrees of political correctness and the doctrines of liberal mind control have swamped Europe to the point where Christian ministers are being arrested for reading Bible passages. It's also an illegal offense in Britain to criticize homosexuality. In November 2002, BBC presenter Robin Page was arrested for saying in a speech a month earlier that the farming community should have the same rights as Muslims, homosexuals, and vegetarians. Police traveled from 200 miles away to question Page before detaining him in a prison cell with dried feces on the wall and later charging him with incitement to racial hatred, simply for stating farmers should have the same rights. In 2001, Gloucestershire police set up Operation Napkin, in which senior police officers were sent to ethnic restaurants to eat four-course dinners and at the same time listen out for racist hate speech. Arrests were made as a result of that program. In January, a student who called a mounted policeman's horse gay was arrested under Section 5 of the Public Order Act for making homophobic remarks and taken to court. Just last month, a 14-year-old schoolgirl was arrested in Manchester for making a racist comment after she refused to work with a group of Asians during a science tutorial because none of them spoke English. Reports of hate crime raids where PC subversives are rounded up like terrorists by police are commonplace. In the U.S., members of the Repent America organization were arrested and criminally charged with prosecutors attempting to secure 47-year prison sentences for the crime of reading Bible passages on the street during Philadelphia's 2004 Outfest Gay Pride March. So that's something to watch out for with the grand new Democratic Congress. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. Our next story coming from the Telegraph UK. U.S. got a license to snoop on British air travelers. Britons flying to America could have their credit card and email accounts inspected by the United States authorities following a deal struck by Brussels and Washington. By using a credit card to book a flight, passengers face having other transactions on the card inspected by the American authorities. Providing an email address to an airline could also lead to scrutiny of other messages sent or received on that account. The extent of the demands were disclosed in undertakings given by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to the European Union and published by the Department for Transport after a Freedom of Information request. About 4 million Britons travel to America each year, and the released document shows that the U.S. has demanded access to far more data than previously realized. Dead Kennedys, I Spy. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. Our next story coming from AP and Yahoo. Gloom and doom in 2007? Question mark? I guess Pat Robertson says so. Another terrorist attack, a warmer planet, death and destruction from a natural disaster. These are among Americans' grim predictions for the United States in 2007. Only a minority of people think the U.S. will go to war with Iran or North Korea over those countries' nuclear ambitions. An overwhelming majority of those surveyed think Congress will raise the federal minimum wage. One-third see hope for a cure to cancer. 6 in 10 people think the U.S. will be the victim of a terrorist attack. An identical percentage thinks it likely that a biological or nuclear weapon will be unleashed somewhere else in the world. 70% of the people polled in the U.S. predict a natural disaster in the country, and an equal percentage expects worsening global warming. Also, 29% think it likely that the U.S. will withdraw its troops from Iraq. Another prediction, 35% the military draft will be reinstated, 35% predict a cure for cancer will be found, 25% anticipate the second coming of Jesus Christ. And also 19% think scientists are likely to find evidence of extraterrestrial life. So that basically tells us that most of the people polled in this country are completely insane. Our next story, once again coming from 9/11 blogger, there was a D.C. 9/11 Truth Conference in November in Washington, D.C. It was called 9/11 Truth to 9/11 Justice. It was at George Mason University. And now all the lectures are posted on Google Video, and they feature speeches from Webster Tarpley, Wayne Mattson, Kevin Barrett, J. Michael Springman, Dr. Robert Bowman, and Daniel Abramson. Now, Webster Griffin Tarpley, radio host and investigative journalist and author of the fantastic book 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA. Wayne Mattson, we had an original recording of him here on the second episode of Media Monarchy. He writes for Wayne Mattson Report, and his book is called Jaded Tasks. Kevin Barrett is a lecturer, and he was a professor of religious studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's the co-founder of the Muslim-Jewish-Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. J. Michael Springman, former chief visa section U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where the CIA repeatedly overruled his rejections and issued visas for 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers. Dr. Robert Bowman, lieutenant colonel, United States Air Force, retired and was the Democratic candidate for Florida's 15th District of Congress. He's a decorated air combat veteran, head of the Star Wars program under Presidents Ford and Carter, Ph.D. in aeronautics and nuclear engineering from Caltech, and a leading expert on national security. All those people were at the 9/11 Truth to 9/11 Justice Conference in D.C. The one guy there, one of my favorites, his name's Daniel Abramson. He runs a website called False Flag News that reports on military practice drills in order to prevent their use as covers for false flag operations. He hosts a show on Republic Broadcasting Network, rbnlive.com, called False Flag News. It's one of my favorites. He's really cool. I was on his show a couple months ago, and we're going to listen to his speech.
He is a journalist and creator of the website falseflagnews.com.
You know,
he reports on military practice drills in order to prevent their use as covers for false flag terror operations. He also has a radio show that appears nightly, or is heard nightly, on RBN Live at 9 p.m. daily. He met Webster Tarpley at the L.A. conference, and they hatched the plan of creating this website, falseflagnews.com, to track the websites, and it's been very effective. And so I would like to introduce, to your applause, Daniel Abramson.
I'd like to begin my speech with a little bit of a story. About 2 weeks ago, I was meeting with a friend of a friend, and I began talking to him about the neocons, and he said, "Oh, you know about the neocons." He said, "Do you know about Douglas Fike? Do you know about Paul Wolfowitz?" And I thought, okay, this is somebody who knows something. And we talked, and I said, "Do you know about the theory that 9/11 was an inside job?" And he said, "Well, I might have heard a little something about that." And I asked him at the end of our conversation, I told him about a lot of the facts, and I said, "Well, what would you do if there were another terror attack on a major American city, let's say a nuclear attack, and a million people were killed?" And he said, "I would quit my job, sign up for the military that day, and go to the Middle East to kill every Arab I could." Now, this is from somebody who understands that the system is corrupted. This is from somebody who understands that the neocons are abusing their power, that the war in Iraq is absolute genocide, that at least 650,000 people have been killed. And yet he said if there were another attack, he would sign up for the military and he would go to kill every Arab. This is the power of false flag terrorism. I think we have a lot of security right now because people look out and they say, well, the Democrats have taken over the power in the Congress and the Senate. We look at the polls and we see that 9/11 Truth is gaining, that 84% of people in America, according to the New York Times, do not accept the official version of 9/11. But according to the Scripps Howard News poll, 36% of Americans have major questions about 9/11, and at least 16% of Americans believe the attacks were the result of a controlled demolition. So our numbers are growing, and this is powerful and it's good, but we should not be overly secure because the power of false flag terrorism to create fear, to manipulate our consciousness, is what drives these people to understand they have social scientist at the Tavistock Institute, at the Stanford Research Institute, who understand this. So I begin my speech with a call for vigilance and not to remain too secure, not to rest on our laurels, and certainly because of a Democratic victory in the House and Senate, not to feel too secure. My goal in this speech today is not to cover the basic facts, WTC-7, the NORAD stand-down, the terror drills, the government prior knowledge. I hope that a lot of you are familiar with these facts, and if you aren't, there's a lot of great websites where you can get that. I would like to talk more about the intelligence situation as it stands right now. As one of my favorite rappers says, ain't a damn thing funny right now. Our troops are surrounded in Baghdad. They are encircled in Baghdad with these supply lines being cut. The supply lines from the Al-Anbar province have been cut, and the other two are in deep peril. We are on the brink of war with Iran, and there are nuclear strike groups in the Persian Gulf right now. And the people who are behind Don Rumsfeld, with or without him, will continue with those plans, in my opinion. We're also looking at a set of war games coming up on December 4th to the 14th, nuclear war games being run by NORCOM. And most importantly, we are looking at a worldwide economic collapse, the death of the petrodollar, the death of the American currency. And this may be happening within the next 2 years. When we understand false flag terrorism, let us understand the entire paradigm that they are trying to cover up, not just what they're doing right now, because they're afraid of the 9/11 truth movement, but they're trying to set up a biometric police state in this country. They are trying to cover up the economic collapse, and they are most certainly trying to get into Iran. So let me talk a little bit about the reasons behind 9/11, some of the origins of the attack, and sort of where we're going from here. As I mentioned before, there are a group of generals inside the military who were behind this attack, in my opinion. A lot of the time we look at the front men, the people like Don Rumsfeld or Dick Cheney, and we say these are the people who are behind the attacks. I think we need to look a little deeper. In fact, it may be best to look at Webster Tarpley's book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror. He describes the call to Bush that morning. Angel is next. And Bush is flown without air support to the Barksdale Air Force Base, where Stratcom is running the Global Guardian drills. And then he's flown to the OFA Air Force Base in Nebraska. These are the controllers. These are the men with their hands on the nuclear weapons. And additionally, these are the men who have been instructed by Dick Cheney that in the event of another 9/11 attack, that they are to launch on Iran. And that's not me talking. Former CIA agent Philip Giraldi told the American conservative, Dick Cheney has instructed Stratcom to carry out Con Plan 8022 in the wake of a new 9/11 on American soil. So this is what I call the 9/11 coup faction, the strange love generals who get their mandate from the Wall Street finance oligarchs that have infested the CIA and definitely control large parts of it. This goes into the Secret Service, Stratcom, NORDCOM. These are the people that were running Vigilant Warrior and Vigilant Guardian that day to disable the Air Force. So we look at the NORAD standout. You only needed a few people to run these drills. And if you look at the NORAD tapes, they're saying, do we have the shoot down order? Do we have the order to shoot down? What's going on? We're going crazy. Well, if you look at the drills, those are the people with the power. You can remove Rumsfeld, and the entrenched, invisible government is still there. So don't feel too secure. We must remain vigilant. So I want to get into also another factor of the invisible government faction nobody's talking about right now. This is the private firms. Let me lay out some of them for you right now. SAIC, AT&T, Raytheon, Bechtel, DynCorp, Lockheed, Kroll, Titan, L3 Communications, Boeing. All of these companies are deeply involved. In fact, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post about a month ago that described the process of green badgers. And they say that in top secret classified meetings right now, at least half of the people are so-called green badgers. These are people from private military firms that now sit in on top secret CIA meetings. So when we're going to talk about the invisible government, or inside job, or they made it happen on purpose, let us also look at the private military firms. Look into SAIC when you want to understand why the NSA is spying on everyone. Who's designing their software? Look into AT&T. So much of the ability of intelligence agencies to infiltrate and carry out false flag terrorism has been conduited right into the private firms with no government oversight, with complete black budgets. And that goes for the drug dealing as well, but that's an aside. So I want to begin talking about the major factors that led us into 9/11. And unfortunately, I cannot do that without first mentioning Israel. And this has become a topic of much contention because There are plenty of infiltrators and Judeophobes and genuine racists and genuine anti-Semites that go around saying Jews run the planet. It's a major Zionist plot. It's all the Jews. Israel runs everything. And what they do, by doing that, they actually mute the message, which is that Israel is incredibly influential and pushing American foreign policy right down. This has nothing to do with religion. I don't speak of the Israeli people. In fact, if you look at a most recent Haaretz poll, Ehud Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister, has a 22% approval rating. The IDF has a 13% approval rating. 70% of American Jews oppose the war in Iraq. So this is not some Jewish plot. I speak of the Israeli government. I speak of the IDF. I speak of Mossad. So let me get into it right here. Can we cue up the next slide? All right. If you haven't heard of the Office of Special Plans, this is one of the major reasons that we are in war in Iraq right now, and I think that this ties far back into 9/11 as well. The Office of Special Plans is described in the UK Guardian article by Julian Borger entitled "The Spies Who Pushed for War." And he writes, "The ideological driven network functioned like a shadow government, much of it off the official payroll and beyond congressional oversight. But it proved powerful enough to prevail in the struggle with the State Department and the CIA by establishing a justification for war." Now here's where it gets interesting. It says, "The OSP was an open and largely unfiltered conduit to the White House, not only for the Iraqi opposition. It also forged close ties to a parallel ad hoc intelligence operation inside Ariel Sharon's office in Israel, specifically to bypass Mossad and provide the Bush administration with more alarmist reports on Saddam's Iraq than Mossad was prepared to authorize." It goes on. It says, "None of the Israelis who came in were cleared through the normal channels. Instead, they were waived on Mr. Douglas' FICE authority without having to fill in the usual forms." So, what we see here in a later Washington Post article, they go on and they say that investigators have specifically asked about a group of neoconservatives involved in defense issues, including Douglas Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, Harold Rode, and others at the Pentagon. FBI agents have asked current and former officials about Richard Perle and the Defense Policy Board with David Wormser, an Iran specialist and principal deputy assistant at the National Security Affairs in Cheney's office. Now, what came of all of this? If there are these articles going on, what came? You may not know that a man named Larry Franklin got a 12-year prison sentence for passing classified information to agents of the group called AIPAC. This is the American Israel Affairs Committee. This is the big Israeli lobby. This man was convicted of passing secrets to Keith Weissman and Steve Rosen, both of whom are now on trial. He has copped a plea and pleaded guilty. So AIPAC became a conduit from the Office of Special Plans into Israel back and forth. This is the conduit that's going on. Two ad hoc groups set up in different countries. But it wasn't just Larry Franklin. It went on to Condoleezza Rice. I have an April 22nd article from 2006. It says, "Rice allegedly leaked defense info." Washington Post, folks, it says, "Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice leaked national defense information to a pro-Israel lobby in the same manner that landed a lower-level Pentagon official a 12-year prison sentence." Now, of course, we know that Condoleezza Rice was working on the White House Iraq group with Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, Mary Madeline, Andrew Carr, James Wilkinson, Stephen Hadley, Scooter Libby. These are your major planners. This is yet another conduit through AIPAC. I could go on here. We have Jane Harman just about a week ago. It was announced by Time magazine that Harman had cut a side deal with AIPAC in which she would be given the House Intelligence Chairmanship and that they were going to influence Nancy Pelosi if she would just back off on the investigation of AIPAC. She backs off and is a quid pro quo. This is from Time magazine. I could talk more about this. There is a role of the Israeli art student spy ring, and this has been reported by Salon magazine. This has been reported by the UBI that over 160 Israelis were arrested prior to 9/11 trying to infiltrate top secret sites in the DEA and the DOD. Carl Cameron from Fox News did a report on it. And he said the following, "There is no indication that the Israelis were involved in the 9/11 attacks, but the investigators suspect that the Israelis have gathered intelligence about the attacks in advance and not share it. A highly placed investigator said there are tie-ins, but when asked for details, he flatly refused to describe them, saying, 'The evidence linking these Israelis to 9/11 is classified. I cannot tell you about the evidence that has been gathered. It is classified information.'" And then before I close here, I think I would be remiss not to mention that on 9/11, we have an article here from the Sunday Herald, and it says there was ruin in Manhattan, but over the Hudson River, a handful of men were dancing. These five men celebrated, and it says, who were they? Palestinians? Saudis? Iraqis? Al-Qaeda, surely? wrong on all counts. There were Israelis, and at least two of them were Israeli intelligence agents working for Mossad, the equivalent of the MI6 or CIA. So the towers are collapsing. These men are videotaping it and dancing and laughing and reporting. This has fallen right down the memory hole. But it goes on. It goes deeper than this. It says that prior to 9/11, the Israelis were organized into cells of four or six people. The significance of what the Israelis were doing didn't emerge until September 11. It says that they were living near suspected hijackers in Hollywood, Florida, and Phoenix, Arizona. The report contended that Mossad agents were spying on Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, two of the leaders of the 9/11 hijack team, or I should say alleged leaders. The pair had settled in Hollywood, Florida, along with three other hijackers after leaving in Hamburg when another Mossad team was operating close by. So when you find these teams of supposed hijackers, wherever you look, whether it's in Florida, Phoenix, San Diego, Germany, you see Mossad right by. This is important. We don't know exactly what this means, but we have to investigate this, and we have to have the courage to do this. Because there's going to be a lot of people that would say, that's anti-Semitism. That this is wrong to look into what Israel is doing, and I can tell you that the Israeli regime is a war criminal regime, that the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank are war crimes, and that when we look into what's happening right now, it's the potential for war in Iran. It goes right into Israel yet again. I have an article from the First Post here, major mainstream newspaper. The suggestion is that the Israeli government has served notice on the White House. This is from 1 week ago, that it must take preemptive action against Iran's sites of nuclear weapons development, or Israel will do the job itself. Israel has apparently given the Bush administration a deadline of 6 months. So we have a foreign government implicated in espionage with a separate intelligence conduit pumping phony propaganda into the Office of Special Plans. These people are cutting side deals with the Democratic Party to cover up the investigation of APEC. And then they have the audacity to come into our country and tell us, well, you must invade. You have to go into Iran or we'll go it alone. So what's going to happen if they go it alone? Do we have the right to feel secure right now? Well, we have an article from the Jerusalem Post, and it says, President Bush, this is from November 2nd, President Bush reportedly said he would understand a preemptive Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear sites. Asked by Chirac if Israel could attack Iran to prevent it from getting the bomb, Bush reportedly said, we cannot rule this out, and if it were to happen, I would understand it. This is tacit support. We know that Dick Cheney went on the Don Imus show last year and said, well, if Israel goes it alone, we'll have to support them. Meanwhile, we know that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, that the military estimate they are at least 5 to 6 years away from a bomb, if they are even trying to acquire one, that the CIA and State Department say they're 9 years away, and even the psychopaths in Mossad say 2 to 3 years. And yet these individuals are trying to push into Iran right now. What's motivating them? What are they trying to accomplish by getting into them? Well, that leads me into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, something you may not have heard of, or you may have heard of. This is a grouping, a counterbalance to the NATO faction. These are the people that are going to oppose a U.S., U.K., Israeli, and NATO action in Iran. This is the group of countries that are establishing an oil and gas pipeline of their own, who are coming to dominate the Central Caspian region, who are coming to dominate the oil market, and who are sending the American currency into a free fall. These are the countries who are now having the courage to say, we do not need to accept American hegemony. We don't need to accept Israeli nuclear threats. We don't need to accept spying in our country, and we can form our own economic and military bloc to oppose total American hegemony. Because if we think that the Chinese and the Russians are too stupid to see what's going on with 9/11, the invasion of Iraq, that would be insane. So let me describe to you the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This was established in July 2001. It includes Russia, China, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. It also links to a separate group known as the Collective Security Treaty Organization, CSTO. This stuff may be dry, but it's important that we learn these terms. We are watching a world war develop, and if you want to see how the sides are going to play, the black versus white side of the chessboard, you need to understand NATO, Israel, UK, and US, and they will be using their proxy states like Georgia and Ukraine. And then we must also understand that the countervailing balance is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, the CSTO is these same countries, except it also includes Armenia and Belarus. This is a direct military alliance. Some people try to say that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is not a military alliance. Well, I have an article here from 2005 when China and Russia, it says, are holding joint military exercises from August 18th to the 25th in China's Shandong province in the Yellow Sea involving 10,000 troops with an array of modern military technology. That was their first major drill. But we also know in 2007, in the beginning, the spring, Russia and China will be running major sets of war games and terror drills. This is the beginning of this alliance taking a military foothold and beginning to say, if you invade Iran, we will not sit idly. We let you invade Iraq, we let you invade Afghanistan and take over major countries in the Caspian region. No longer will that happen. So from the article about the 2007 drill, it says, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov told the news conference, quote, the SCO is not a military alliance, but according to its charter, it has the right to use arms to react to any challenge, like terrorism. So these drills and these war games are only done under the aegis of terrorism. And the Chinese defense minister said the following. He said that, quote, defense cooperation as an important work of the SCO witnessed smooth development among defense departments of the member countries, and regular defense ministries meetings will be a major mechanism for ensuring a suitable and stable environment for the defense cooperation. In October 2006, we had another war game run by the Chinese. If you want to know what the future looks like, if you want to know why we want to prevent World War III, you only need to look into the kinds of weapon systems that are being developed right now. Do you know about the HARP system, which can monitor and edit our weather system? Or the kind of nanotechnology that they're sitting on, smart dust, the kind of RFID chips, the Vera chips, the biometric police state, the cancel society control grid, all part of the technological development, but we also need to look at the future weapon systems. In the Project for the New American Century, they said that genetically engineered viruses will be a, quote, politically useful tool. They're talking about mass genocide. They are talking about exoskeleton soldiers. They are talking about nuclear weapons in space. And they are also talking about electromagnetic warfare. Weapons that could shut down an entire battlefield by frying them with electromagnetics. So we have this war game in October 2006. Just went on. It says, a motorized division of the Chinese People's Liberation Army launched a war exercise under the codename Keshan 2006 on Thursday in an attempt to test its fighting capabilities under an electromagnetic environment. So why are the Chinese preparing for an electromagnetic war? Do you think that they know something's coming? Do you think that they see World War III on the doorstep? In this same month of October 2006, I have this article from the UPI. China has beamed a ground laser at U.S. spies over its territory, a U.S. agency says. The action exposed potential vulnerability of space systems that provide crucial data to American troops and consumers around the world. So early in the month, they run an electromagnetic warfare drill. Later in the month, they're frying U.S. space weapon systems. Is this a message? This is what's going on behind the scenes right now. The war is being fought diplomatically. It's being fought economically. The weapons haven't started firing yet, but we are getting to that point. I'm going to need a drink of water. If I'm speaking too fast, it's because 45 minutes goes really quickly and I've got a lot to cover here. Bear with me. Hopefully this will be on videotape and I'll catch up with it. Alright.
There's nothing more romantic than fantasy, and we can make the war on terror distract them like videos and TV shows with scantily clad women, cover them with oil, rub it in like lotion, put F-16s in the skies and battleships in the ocean. The voters won't notice. Tell them you're either with us or you're against us, and in the same breath, over-vaccinate our soldiers. They'll want to believe these lies are the truth to the point that even Cynthia McKinney with proof won't be able to convince them that there's a connection between the war on terror and the Carlisle Group. They'll need to believe these lies are true. I said over-vaccinate our soldiers and coat their ammunition with radioactive DU. Fear is the final frontier of the defenseless. If it's logical, tell them it's senseless. You're either with us or you're against us. It's all about confusion. Name it the Patriot Act if it acts against the Constitution. One man, one vote is a joke. You should be more concerned about your family being broke. Poof. Mirrors. Smoke. Now, watch me raise spending and lower taxes. The answer to any question that the 911 Commission might ask is, we believe that stem cell research is immoral. North Korea has WMD's translation. Time for Operation Iraqi Freedom. Sacrifice American lives on Baghdad soil. Earn more from our investments in defense and increase our supply of oil. The question is, how come we haven't done anything about the genocide in Darfur? The answer is, we believe in protecting the sanctity of marriage. Just give them a slogan. Let's roll. We're gonna smoke them out of their holes. Watch the hands
watch the hands. And this hand, Osama bin Laden. And this hand, the World Trade Center explodes now. I know you want me to get them for you, but the $200 billion question is, how much is it worth to you for me to allow my cronies' investments in defense to work for you? Don't worry about what we knew prior to the fact about the attacks. That's a distraction. Carol Ann, look away from the oil fields. The important thing to remember is that voting for my opponent will get you killed. There's a connection between his election and your family's demise. That's why African-American voters have to be disenfranchised. Neo-democracy means the electronic voting machine companies get to help us decide. That way you can win the election and still lose. That's the new world order. Global economy, no borders, no sovereignty, widow's cries, corporate plutocracy. True lies.
And that rhyme, True Lies, is coming from GNN.TV. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Our next story should be at the top of the show, but it's reaching towards the end of the show. U.S. death toll in Iraq reaches 3,000. The death of a Texas soldier announced last Sunday by the Pentagon raised the number of U.S. military deaths in Iraq to at least 3,000 since the war began, according to an AP count. The grim milestone was crossed on the final day of 2006 and at the end of the deadliest month for the American military in Iraq in the past 12 months. At least 111 U.S. service members were reported to have died in December. Dustin R. Danica, 22, of Spring, Texas, was killed last Thursday by small arms fire in Baghdad, the Defense Department said. His death was not announced by the U.S. military authorities in Baghdad. At least 820 U.S. military personnel died in Iraq in 2006, according to the AP count. And now, of course, that's been about a week, so it's now, of course, even higher than that.
Where did Substance D come from? Why can't we stop it? The bigger this war gets, the more freedoms we lose, the more Substance D is on our streets. Can't you figure this out?
Look around you. Look how far we've come. Humanity wasn't meant to live like this. Our every waking moment, tracked and traced and scanned. It's time to stop submitting to this tyranny. It's time to realize that we're being enslaved. Uh-oh, it's our tax dollars at work. Protect us from ourselves. Hey, guys, I used to be one of you. Stop selling out your own species.
The FEMA plans to imprison American citizens have generated a lot of interest around the country in locating the potential prison camps throughout the country. These may be facilities currently being used as prisons, such as those you saw earlier, or prisons that are being built supposedly in the name of the war on drugs, or facilities that have other uses but which could be quickly used to detain large numbers of people, such as this Amtrak facility in Beech Grove, Indiana. We're standing now in the main parking lot, which doesn't look too sinister. At this level, it is a very large parking lot, fenced on all sides by fence topped by barbed wire. It also has these electronically operated turnstiles. There is also a surveillance camera, just like we saw at the FEMA facility, pointing out to the parking lot, and a helicopter windsock. All of these apparent security measures are particularly unusual here, because this is a very low crime area, and this facility is nothing but an old train repair station with nothing in it worth stealing. In this portion of the parking lot is a brick building, suitable for processing, next to a gate that leads right out to the railroad track. And all of this is contained inside a fully fenced area, now three layers deep in fencing at this point. This U.S. Air Force train indicates federal and military involvement. Facing the opposite direction, you can see that this area, too, is a very large fenced area with railroad track running the length of the fence and plenty of warehouses. This facility was supposed to have closed in June of 1993, yet instead, several million dollars in federal funds have been spent on supposed renovations over the past 2 years. Helicopter windsocks and markers are evident throughout the property. This small building is the only way into a particular fenced area. Inside this building, we see more of the motion-activated detectors, electronic turnstiles, and prison bars. All of the renovations to this property have involved putting in new fencing, electronic turnstiles, concrete flooring in unused warehouse buildings, and putting in large gas furnaces on buildings that were never heated any time in the past 20 years. Outside this building is fencing and a cattle run section of fence, all topped by barbed wire, pointing inward, not to keep people out, but to keep people in. This was common throughout the facility, particularly the new fencing that had been erected. Inside the fence area on the other side of the building, you see signs that say Red Zone, right up next to the railroad tracks that run the length of the fence area. Next to the Red Zone sign, you can see closely numbered markers on the fences that are too closely spaced to be parking markers, just as if they plan to have people line up to board the train. Here's a helicopter marker on the power lines outside the facility, indicating expected helicopter traffic, and again, another tall radio antenna. Looking around, you can get an idea of how huge this place is and how many people it could contain in its fenced-in area. In yet another fenced area, we see a large warehouse building at the end, with the electronic turnstiles in front of it. The building is one that has a new concrete floor, and its doors and windows have all been blocked. Outside, there are new gas pipes. Even as we were filming, a black helicopter flew over us, observing what we were doing, which has happened many times when we have been at the facility. The gas lines and gas pipes at the facility run the length of the building and come out at some very, very large, brand new furnaces that have been installed at the buildings throughout the facility. We found this crane, which has seen better days, but is plainly marked U.S. Army in the middle of the stockyard. We found other fully working military trucks and equipment here at other times. Inside the facility, we found large fenced-in areas next to the railroad tracks marked Green Zone and Blue Zone, suitable for holding a lot of people. Many of the old warehouse buildings have had new concrete floors put into them. Unused sections of railroad track have been dug up and replaced, and from the supplies in the stockyards, it is obvious they will be doing even more construction and fencing. Senator Lugar of Indiana recently obtained more federal funding to renovate this facility, which is supposedly only for the repair of broken trains and where most of the buildings on the property haven't been used for years. It certainly appears they are expecting more than just broken trains. This tower, overlooking the entire facility at one end of the facility along the railroad tracks, also has a radio antenna on it with a ladder up inside of it. It would make an excellent watchtower.
That's Primal Scream with their song, A Scanner Darkly. And before that, we heard a clip from the film, A Scanner Darkly, featuring the Alex Jones cameo. Wrapping it up here on this ninth episode of Media Monarchy, it's January 5th, 2007. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com is where you want to go for all the sounds and news and views and videos that you hear on this show. Coming from the Houston Chronicle, Iris Scan database of children forms. Technology developed to keep track of prisoners by scanning their irises became available last Thursday to identify missing children. Part of an effort to image the irises of 5 million children into a nationwide database over the next few years, said Robert Melly, Vice President and CEO of Biometric Intelligence and Identification. But I'm sure this will only be used for the children. And the Military Commissions Act isn't for American citizens, and the detention centers being built are for immigration emergency. Our last story, coming from the BBC, I mentioned it last week, you don't have to be a genius or a palm reader to see into the future, to see how this is going to roll out. I reported last week to you that Saddam's execution was going to be videotaped and that it would be leaked, and of course it was, and everyone enjoyed another snuff film like JFK's assassination and the towers. So coming from the BBC, Saddam Hussein executed in Iraq. Former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has been executed by hanging at an unspecified location outside Baghdad's Green Zone for crimes against humanity. So that's the BBC's take on it, but Wayne Madsen has a better and more insightful intake. Coming from WayneMadsenReport.com, Iraq's former dictator managed to avoid one of the world's most high-tech assassination efforts during the Iraq War campaign, only to be allegedly discovered by U.S. forces hiding in a hole in the ground near Tikrit. There is little doubt that the trial of Saddam Hussein by a U.S. puppet government in the Green Zone of Baghdad has been a charade and a miscarriage of justice. Saddam's death sentence, decided by an Iraqi government-appointed and U.S.-approved judge on December 26, was never in doubt, considering the knowledge the former Iraqi leader possesses of past crimes of the Bush family and their coterie of friends and partners in providing Iraq with much of the biological and chemical weaponry used against the Kurds, Shias, and Iranians. Saddam Hussein's willingness to provide the Western media with documents and other evidence of the connivance of George H.W. Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Frank Carlucci, and other Reagan-Bush administration principals was made apparent to this editor in the months preceding the March 2003 American attack on Iraq. A senior Iraqi official contacted a British colleague of this editor and passed on a personal offer from Saddam Hussein to provide an enterprising Western journalist with the proof of America's sanctioning of Saddam's use of U.S.-supplied chemical and biological weapons during the Iran-Iraq War, including Iraq's attack on the Kurdish village of Halabja. Also included in Saddam's package would be top-secret information regarding his role as a longtime asset for the CIA, dating back from his student days in Cairo. The evidence of the author passed to this editor, this is Wayne Mattson talking, via the British interlocutor was that Saddam, aware that George W. Bush was going to attack Iraq, ordered his intelligence service to gather up all incriminating evidence that would show the world that Iraq's past weapons of mass destruction were provided by Reagan and Bush 1 administrations. This proof undoubtedly included tape-recorded conversations between Saddam and his advisors and Ronald Reagan's personal envoy to Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld. Saddam hoped that the exposure of the Reagan-Bush administration would embarrass Washington and derail its attack plans. The offer from Baghdad was straightforward. Arrive in Baghdad overland from Jordan and the proof would be handed over. There was one slight hitch. Having such incriminating evidence, documents, and proof that the Reagan administration and that of George W. Bush's father aided and abetted in Saddam's military use of chem bioweaponry against Iranians and his own people would have likely made any enterprising Western journalist an inviting target for a number of bad actors the movement had created. Ironically, Saddam Hussein was more willing to provide the media with classified and sensitive information to expose the machinations of the United States than anyone in the George W. Bush administration or that of his father. It is very clear why the Bush administration wants Saddam dead, and it has nothing to do with Saddam's alleged crimes against humanity. And there we go. That's our final story this week on Media Monarchy. I thank you for joining me. If you're downloading the podcast from radioforall.net, I appreciate it. Pass it on. Add a link to your page, and we can keep this going and hopefully get better and better each week here on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. So I thank you for listening. My name's James. Take care.
Made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.